Chapter 2. The History of UFOs. Part 1. When I decided to write this book, I thought a good place to start my research would be at the infamous Area 51. It is such a well-known hotspot for UFO activity. But what most people don't realize is that UFO activity and accounts of aliens visiting planet Earth have been reported for quite some time now. So let's journey back in time and take a look at the history of UFO sightings from around the world, and again, you tell me if somebody hasn't been planning this deception for a very long time.
Most people today envision UFOs to be exactly as they are portrayed in most science fiction films and books. This is, of course, a relatively recent conception that has been stimulated perhaps by our expanding knowledge of outer space, but strange sights appeared in the skies long before space flight or manned flight of any kind was possible. And in each century these visions took on identities that tell much about the worldview of those who saw them.
Alexander the Great and his armies, for instance, were harassed by a pair of flying objects in 329 BC. Most of the soldiers fled the scene, but some of the hardier men stood their ground and tried to hit the disc with their arrows and with stones from their slings.
Engraved onto a French token, minted in the 1860s, is a disc-shaped flying object that experts say may have commemorated a daytime UFO sighting.
There were sightings in 1897 of a lighter-than-air ship that had propellers, porthole windows, and brilliant search lights that pointed at the ground.
I don't know if you noticed or not, but right out of the gate in looking at the history of UFO sightings, they changed their appearance to the changing technology of the culture. To me, this is your first clue that something fishy is going on here. Let's start with the last one that was mentioned there in the late 1800s, the mystery or phantom airships. This class of UFOs are best known from a series of newspaper reports originating in the western United States and spreading east during the late 1800s. In fact, airship reports were made worldwide, as early as the 1880s, and they're considered to be the cultural predecessor to modern extraterrestrial piloted flying saucer-style UFO claims. Typical airship reports involved unidentified lights, but more detailed accounts reported ships comparable to a dirigible or blimp. Reports of the alleged crewmen and pilots usually describe them as human-looking, although sometimes the crew claimed to be from Mars. Now stop and think about that. Why appear as a blimp back then and not the same kind of aircraft people see today? Did your technology really change that drastically, and or did you really travel from Mars on a blimp? Or are you mimicking people's flying technology based upon their generation and then changing it to fit or mimic the next generation's technology that has now become much more advanced? Can you say deceptive? But let's fast forward a little bit. In 1942, the Hopei incident in China was an alleged UFO sighting that was spotted and photographed but was tucked away in a scrapbook. A young Japanese student was going through his father's photographs from the China campaign and discovered a photo with a strange cone-shaped object in the sky. It showed several people in the street looking up and two pointing up at the object. It is reported that a sidewalk photographer snapped a picture of the strange machine. Also, in 1942, at the Battle of LA, Los Angeles, California, was an account of unidentified aerial objects triggering the firing of thousands of anti-aircraft rounds and raised the wartime alert status. It was just 3 months after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and it was originally assumed to be another air strike from Japan. The identity of the object is still unknown today.
Los Angeles, California, in the early months of 1942, the city was on edge. The recent surprise attack on Pearl Harbor had propelled America into World War II, and the threat of Japanese invasion by sea or by air kept the military on full alert. Chris Pittman, UFO investigator.
Pearl Harbor was a very recent memory for people. People were in high alert. There was a great deal of suspicion. Japanese Americans were being put in internment camps. There were German U-boats in the Atlantic, Japanese submarines in the Pacific, and people were very fearful.
In a well-organized defense operation, air raid wardens and the Coast Guard were monitoring the Pacific shoreline as never before. Albert W. Metz.
The war had started. I was a 13-year-old kid, and this one night, which was February 1942, the sirens started wailing in the middle of the night. Blackout. And we had several blackouts before this.
On February 25, between the hours of 3:12 a.m. and 4:15 a.m., the 37th Coast Artillery Brigade in Los Angeles fired off a barrage of anti-aircraft shells at an unidentified flying object. CBS broadcast.
We're here on the rooftop of the Columbian Broadcasting Building in the heart of Hollywood. We can plainly see the flashes of guns and searchlights sweeping the skies in a wide arc along the coastal area.
Professor C. Scott Littleton, PhD.
I think what woke me up initially was the sound of anti-aircraft guns. I jumped out of bed, my parents were up. My father was an air warden and he figured this has to be the real thing.
Dorothy Mattage.
My mother was telling my brother and I get under the bed. Get under the bed. Stay there. And of course we got out and we peeked. There was all this firing. It was almost like a 4th of July.
Albert W. Metz.
I started to hear a lot of loud explosions. My brother and I looked out the bedroom window, saw searchlights twisting and turning in the sky. But what was the strange UFO that the searchlights were focused on? Where had it come from? Japan? Or somewhere from out of this world?
Could this incredible photograph that was published the next morning in the Los Angeles Times provide the proof? Could ancient astronaut theorists have been right all along?
Professor C. Scott Littleton.
It was practically overhead, and I mean overhead.
Retired anthropology Professor C. Scott Littleton was 9 years old and growing up at Hermosa Beach when he spotted the strange object hovering right over his house.
We saw what my mother always called a silver bug. I'd characterize it today as a lozenge, a long oval. It was something I'll never ever forget. In 1942, this is the opinion of what was seen at night in Los Angeles. It was caught in searchlight beams and anti-aircraft shells were exploding all around it. It gradually went like this, motions in a sideways crashing motion, and then began to lose altitude a little bit as it moved over what had to have been Redondo Beach. We lost track of it, but the banging continued. Very quickly afterwards, we all saw, a flight of planes following the track of the object, going overhead, anywhere from 3 to 5 interceptors, clearly piston-driven, US planes. No one has ever admitted those planes were in the sky. My first thought immediately was a Japanese observation plane. Later, the Japanese records definitively prove that there were no Japanese planes over Southern California that night, or indeed ever.
After ruling out the possibility that a Japanese plane had invaded American airspace, Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox attributed the incident to war nerves.
But Secretary of War Henry Stenson quickly refuted this explanation,
defensively declaring that an actual aircraft had been the target of the assault. To this day, no one seems to know just what or who was hovering over Los Angeles that night.
By a process of elimination, the most efficient, and I say this as a scholar, the most efficient explanation is that it was what we call today a UFO. Something not of this world, something that belonged to another technology. If that's true, then this event was one of the largest mass UFO sightings in history. Over 1 million people saw it.
Now, let's fast forward to 1946, and that is where we had the ghost rockets in Scandinavia. These were objects that were sighted repeatedly over Scandinavia, even to the point where the Swedish defense staff expressed their concern.
Interviewer.
You spoke in your presentation about certain events that took place over Scandinavia in the mid-40s. Objects that were seen, and what were those objects, and what was the interest in terms of defense following that?
A member of the Swedish defense staff.
In the summer of 1946, there was a massive wave of what became known as ghost rockets, sometimes spook bombs they were called. They seemed to be concentrated in Scandinavia, Sweden. There's no doubt about that, but the fact of the matter is that it was a worldwide phenomenon. They were seen as far south as India. There were reports from Turkey, from Greece, and there were other events around the world at this time. But definitely the concentration was over Sweden, and for several weeks in the summer of 1946 these things were seen. There were thousands of reports, several thousand reports, and they were often seen like trailing fire. Sometimes not trailing anything. They were generally described as tubular objects. Very occasionally wing-type protrusions were seen, but often no protrusions at all, such as would be required to guide a rocket, like guiding vanes on a rocket, such as V-2. The consensus of opinion at that time was that the Russians were test-flying V-2 rockets captured from the Nazis. Both the Americans and the Russians had captured V-2 Nazi rockets, and they were certainly doing some experiments with them. But 1946, it was far too early for the Russians to have developed anything so sophisticated, because these things were diving into lakes. They were seen leaving lakes in some cases. they were encountered by Saab bombers. There was one craft which actually struck one of them. There was a collision with one of the Saab bombers. The three-man crew was lost. This made headlines, a story in the Washington Post, completely unexplained, and these were not anybody's rockets that we know of. They were not Russian, because one of the world's leading aviation historians, Bill Gungstun, has confirmed in my book. There is no way that so many sightings could be attributed to Russian experiments, and why would you fly them over the middle of Stockholm? It wouldn't make any sort of sense. Besides, they didn't look anything like V2S.
Were they moving at variable speeds?
Variable speeds. Sometimes proceeding at a leisurely pace, sometimes at tremendously high speeds, and varying altitudes. So, it remains unexplained. In 1946, you also had the Engelm incident in Sweden. A gentleman named Gösta Karlsson reported seeing a UFO and its alien passengers. A model of a flying saucer is now erected at the site. Then in 1947 we had the Maury Island incident in Washington State. A gentleman named Harold A. Dahl reported that his dog was killed, and his son was injured by encounters with UFOs. He also claimed that a witness was threatened by men in black. The mystery continues right on up to today.
Like fog on a fall day, a haze of mystery still surrounds Maury Island nearly 60 years after a supposed spaceship sighting that's still not fully explained. It's been written about in books, even captured in the comics, but outside of hardcore mystery buffs, few people know about what may have happened 2 weeks before the most famous UFO sighting.
Philip Lipson, Seattle Museum of Mysteries.
People are always talking about Roswell, and very few people realize the first UFO incident was in Puget Sound.
A man named Harold Dahl and his 15-year-old son were out in a boat salvaging logs just off Maury Island. It was the afternoon of June 21, 1947, when they saw six large donut-shaped objects appear overhead. One seemed to be having problems staying airborne, Dahl says, as he quickly brought the boat to shore. The troubled UFO began dropping tons of hot metal and rocks. Dahl says that his son was even burned on the arm and their dog was killed by the dump of debris.
The whole beach was said to be covered with that sludge. No one knows for sure if it had been previously dumped here by a local smelter or if it indeed fell from a saucer in the sky, but it did get the attention of the government.
Two Air Force officers soon arrived. They studied the facts, scooped up some of the sludge, climbed onto a plane and died.
Their B-25 crashed near Kelso. Philip Lipson.
And there's some reports that there might have been sabotage, that there was somebody that was trying to stop them from analyzing it and somehow caused their plane to crash. The Air Force investigation of the crash site was classified, and the site still hasn't been thoroughly investigated by an outside agency. That's part of why the mystery of what happened at Maury Island still endures today. I think they did see UFOs and something dropped sludge on the beach.
Then in 1947 we had the infamous Kenneth Arnold UFO sighting in Washington State. 3 days after the Maury Island incident, this UFO sighting sparked for the very first time the term flying saucer. While flying near Mount Rainier, Washington, pilot Kenneth Arnold spotted a formation of nine silvery crescent-shaped objects flying in tight formation. He described the disked movements to a reporter as like pie plates skipping over the water. In his story the next day, the reporter coined the term flying saucers, and the label has stuck ever since then. Later, he estimates their size at 40 to 50 feet wide, their speed at a fantastic 1,200 miles per hour, more than twice as fast as any known aircraft of that day. In fact, here's the actual original radio broadcast immediately after the event took place.
Every newscaster and newspaper across the nation has made headline out of it, and this afternoon we are honored indeed to have here in our studio this man, Kenneth Arnold, who we believe may be able to give us a first-hand account, and give you the same, of what happened. Kenneth, first of all, if you'd move up here to the microphone just a little bit closer, we'll ask you to just tell in your own fashion, as you told us last night in your hotel room and again this morning, what you were doing there and how this entire thing started.
Go ahead, Kenneth.
Well, at about 2:15 I first took off from Jahalis, Washington on route to Yakima, and of course every time any of us fly over the country near Mount Rainier we spent an hour or two in search of the Marine plane that's never been found, that they believe is in the snow someplace southwest of that particular area. That area is located at about 10,000 feet and I had made one sweep past Mount Rainier and down one of the canyons and was dragging it for any types of objects that might prove to be the Marine ship, and as I came out of the canyon after about 15 minutes, I was approximately 25 to 28 miles from Mount Rainier. I climbed back up to 9,200 feet and noticed to the left of me a chain which looked to me like the tail of the Chinese kite, kind of weaving and going at a terrific speed across the face of Mount Rainier. At first, I thought they were geese because they flew like geese, but it was going so fast that I immediately changed my mind and thought that it was a bunch of new jet planes in formation. Well, as the planes came to the edge of Mount Rainier flying at about 160 degrees south, I thought I would clock them because it was such a clear day and I didn't know what their destination was. But due to the fact that I had Mount St. Helens and Mount Adams to clock them by, I just thought I'd see how fast they were going. Among pilots, we argue about speed so much, and they seem to flick and flash in the sun just like a mirror. In fact, I happened to be at an angle from the sun that happened to hit the tops of these peculiar-looking things, in such a way that it almost blinded you when you looked at them through your plexiglass windshield. It was about 1 minute to three when I started clocking them on my sweep second-hand clock, and as I kept looking at them, I kept looking for their tails. They didn't have any tails. Well, I thought maybe there was something wrong with my eyes. I turned the plane around and opened the window. Sure enough, I couldn't find any tails on them, and the whole observation of these ships didn't last more than about 2.5 minutes. I could see them only when they seemed to tip their wing or whatever it was, and the sun flashed on them. They looked something like a pie plate that was cut in half, with a convex triangle in the rear. Now I thought, maybe they're jet planes with the tails painted green or brown or something, and I didn't think too much of it but kept watching them. They didn't fly in the conventional formation that's taught in our army. They seemed to kind of weave in and out right above the mountain top. I would say that they even went down into the canyons on several instances, probably 100 feet. But I could see them against the snow, of course, on Mount Rainier and on the snow on Mount Adams as they were flashing against a high ridge that happens to lay in between Mount Rainier and Mount Adams. But when I observed the tail end of the last one passing Mount Adams, I was at an angle near the Mount Rainier summit, but I looked at my watch and it showed 1 minute and 42 seconds. Well, I thought that's pretty fast, but I didn't stop to think what the distance was between the two mountains. Well, I landed at Yakima, Washington, and Al Baxter were there to greet me. After I told him what I saw, he told me he guessed I had better change my brand, but he kind of gave me a mysterious sort of a look, maybe I had seen something, he didn't know. I just kind of forgot it then and got down to Pendleton and began looking at my map and taking measurements on it, and the best calculation I could figure out, and even allowing for error, it would be around 1200 miles an hour. Because making the distance between Mount Rainier to Mount Adams in approximately 2 minutes, it'd be around 25 miles per minute. Now allowing for error, we can give them 3 or 4 minutes to make it, and they're still going more than 800 miles an hour, and, in my knowledge, there isn't anything I have read about outside some of the German rockets that would go that fast. These were flying in more or less a level constant altitude. They weren't going up and they weren't going down, they were simply staying straight and level, and I laughed when I told the men they sure should have had a tail, but it didn't seem to help me much. To the best of my knowledge, and the best of my description, that is what I saw, and like I told the Associated Press, I'd be glad to confirm it with my hands on a Bible because I did see it. And whether it has anything to do with our army or our intelligence, or whether it has to do with some foreign country, I don't know. But I did see it, I did clock it, and I just happened to be in a beautiful position to do it. It's just as much a mystery to me as it is to everyone else who's been calling me the last 24 hours wondering what it was.
After Arnold's initial report, UFO sightings in our skies exploded. On June 26, 4 witnesses, including a doctor, saw a huge silver globe moving along the rim of the Grand Canyon. 2 days after that, an Air Force pilot reported a flight of 6 discs over Lake Mead, Nevada, and within days, reports were pouring in from Michigan, Ohio, Oregon, Louisiana, and as far north even Canada. Then of course we have, in 1947, the Roswell UFO incident in Roswell, New Mexico. This is the infamous account where the United States Army Air Force allegedly captured a flying saucer. It is reported that they recovered debris from an alien aircraft that was found in the desert of New Mexico, and thus began one of the biggest controversies and mysteries in U.S. history, including great suspicion of a government cover-up. And then in 1948 we have the green fireballs in the southwest United States. Objects were reported over several United States military bases, and an official investigation followed. Also, in 1948 the Mantell UFO incident in Kentucky. The U.S. Air Force sent a fighter pilot to investigate a UFO sighting over Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Unfortunately, the pilot was killed while pursuing the UFO.
There is a great scene in the movie Independence Day, when the pilot sacrifices his life to bring down an alien mothership. Well, that was fiction, but nearly 60 years ago, a National Guard pilot in Kentucky died in the pursuit of a UFO. Drew Spear is here with the ongoing mystery behind the death of Captain Thomas Mantell.
A mystery indeed. This season it came on the heels of another UFO story that came on the air in the summer of 1947. That's when a UFO allegedly crashed in Roswell, New Mexico. That story, of course, well documented, but this equally puzzling mystery regarding a UFO in the skies above Kentucky just a few months after the Roswell incident. In our report, a 1956 government film, addressing this case, a case that will never be solved, because Captain Thomas Mantell, from Simpson County, Kentucky, an experienced pilot and World War II ace, took the answers to his grave. It made headlines across the country. January 7, 1948, 1:30 p.m. Kentucky State Police receive reports of a UFO near Godman Air Force Base. One reports,
"It's like seeing one green bright shiny star. I don't know, it appears like a star now."
Four F-51 Mustangs on their way from the Sanford Air Force Base, Kentucky, are contacted by the tower.
"Godman Tower to Captain Mantell, investigating an unidentified object in your area."
They're wanting to investigate an unidentified object, 1 to 200 feet in diameter. One plane returns for fuel and oxygen, the three others approach the object.
"Mantell to tower, I see it. Above and ahead of me. I'm still climbing."
The planes climb to 22,000 feet too high for World War II fighters without oxygen. Two planes return to the base, leaving Captain Mantell in sole pursuit of the unknown. Minutes later, Mantell with another transmission.
"Mantell to tower, it appears to be a metallic object of tremendous size."
Captain Mantell kept climbing, most likely above 30,000 feet. Radio contact was lost.
"Captain Mantell, come in, over. This is Goodman Tower to Captain Mantell, come in, over."
Minutes later, less than 2 hours from the initial sightings, Mantell's F-51 crashed on a farm in Franklin, Kentucky. His watch stopped at 3:16 p.m., his body still strapped in his plane. By all accounts, he passed out from a lack of oxygen, forcing his plane to plunge to the ground. Today, a historical marker sits near the site where Mantell's plane went down here in Franklin, Kentucky. In fact, it went down on a farm nearby Joe Phillips Farm. His son, a school child then, was one of the first on the scene.
"We heard this real loud boom, you know, it actually shook the house. Best I remember, it was two of them. Like an explosion."
William Phillips Jr. was 6 years old and homesick with his younger sister when the crash occurred.
"We ran to the window and we just happened to run to the right window and see it hit the ground, just as it hit the ground."
The news of the incident immediately made the headlines. Newspapers reporting that Mantell had been shot down by a magnetic ray from a flying saucer. The story took on a life of its own. He was the first person ever to die while pursuing an unidentified flying object. The military's response, most likely he was chasing a weather balloon.
"I can't see that a balloon could move and outrun a P-51. The P-51 was the fastest plane the military virtually had in 47.
It's a story almost 60 years later, that's still talked about in Franklin, Kentucky, where Mantell was born and oddly enough died, just a few miles from the Simpson County Tourism Center where he is honored. Dan Ware, Simpson County Tourism.
There are many UFO buffs who stop by to ask and see what we got and then want to know as much as they can about the story. It continues to fascinate people even after 50 years. Several years later, when they restructured the project, Project Sign was the first one and they were serious. They came to the conclusion that we were dealing with something from somewhere else.
Project Sign later became Project Blue Book because Mantell was a respected pilot and gave the UFO story credibility, the military was concerned.
If you look in the Blue Book archives, which is the Air Force records, it shook up a lot of military people. After searching all the records and after the Air Force claimed that it was a skyhook balloon, they had pretty good records on all the launches, but they never could establish a launch date for that day.
Also, there were several reported sightings of UFOs on the day of Mantell's death, including Madisonville and Owensboro. Newly found documents left off the Blue Book records that showed some of these objects were maneuvering and could not be attributed to balloons of any kind. So, for now, this case remains a mystery.
In 1948, we have the Gorman dogfight in North Dakota. A U.S. Air Force pilot sighted and pursued a UFO for 27 minutes over Fargo, North Dakota. Gorman approached the object to investigate it, and suddenly it brightened and accelerated. The object had been traveling about 250 miles per hour, but as Gorman began the chase, it sped up to about 600 miles per hour. The P-51 could only travel 400 miles per hour, so the object quickly outdistanced Gorman. It then made a 180-degree turn and came straight at him. Gorman attempted to crash into it, but as they neared, it veered upward and passed over him. In 1950, we had the Mariana UFO incident in Great Falls, Montana. The manager of Great Falls pro baseball team took color film of two UFOs flying over Great Falls, Montana. The film was extensively analyzed by the U.S. Air Force and independent investigators.
The following was recorded August 15, 1950. It was taken in Great Falls, Montana by Nick Mariana. Immediately after we were notified of the sighting, we sent an intelligence man to get a record. Nick Mariana.
My name is Nick Mariana. For the last 6 years, I've been the general manager for a minor league baseball club called the Electrics. We play out of Great Falls, Montana, and are a farm club for the Brooklyn Dodgers. On August 15, 1950 at Legion Ballpark in Great Falls, Montana, after a couple of hours in the clubhouse office, I went up into the grandstand to call the groundskeeper. As I reached the top of the stairway, I glanced northward to the tall Anaconda Copper Company smokestack to check the direction of the wind from the white smoke. A force of habit, I suppose, because our outfielders use it as an indicator on defensive play. As I looked up, I saw two silvery objects moving swiftly out of the northwest. They appeared to be moving directly south. The objects were very bright and about 10.000 feet in the air. They appeared to be of a bright shiny metal, like polished silver. Both were the same size and going the same rate of speed, which was much slower than the jets which shot by shortly after I filmed the discs. Suddenly they stopped. It was then that I remembered the camera in the glove compartment of my car. I raced downstairs yelling for my secretary, Miss Virginia Ronnie. The distance from the top of the stairway to my car was about 60 feet, and I must have made that in about six jumps. I asked my secretary if she saw anything, and she said yes, two silvery spheres. I unlocked the glove compartment of my car, took out the camera, turned the telephoto lens on the turret into position, set the camera at F22, picked up the objects on the viewfinder, and pressed the trigger. The discs appeared to be spinning like a top and were about 50 feet across and about 50 yards apart. I could not see any exhaust, wings, or any kind of fuselage. There was no cabin, no odor, no sound, except I thought I heard a whooshing sound when I first saw them. As the film clicked through the camera, I could see the objects moving southeast behind the General Mills grain building and the Blackwater tank directly south of the ballpark. I filmed the objects until they disappeared into the blue sky behind the water tank. The Montana film, Two Objects, was photographed at about 11:30 a.m. MST. During the forenoon, the surface wind was 25 to 28 miles per hour. It reached 37 miles per hour at 12:30 p.m. The objects moved almost directly counter to the wind direction. They were not balloons. Studies of the magnified pictures projected, frame by frame, show the motion of the objects to have been steady and horizontal. They were definitely not free-falling. They were not meteors, bird, not any kind of known aircraft. This is the Montana film projected exactly as it was photographed. The objects are moving against a 25 to 28 miles per hour wind. This is the film in double frame or slow motion. A slight bounce in the movement of the objects as well as the tower is perceptible. This is due to the handheld camera. The film analyzed frame by frame shows the movement of the objects are horizontal and steady. We will now vary the action and size of the objects and also stop the action from time to time for your study. We have just made a jump cut of the film to an enlarged size and reversed the action. You are now seeing the objects exactly as they were photographed but from a closer perspective. Analysis reveals that the objects are not balloons nor any kind of known aircraft. The images are very different from those produced by any kind of bird at any distance. The shape, brightness, speed, rectilinear path, steady motion and any separation rules out any forms of optical atmospheric mirages or cloud reflections. Comprehensive analysis has eliminated meteors and other known natural phenomena. The possibility of airplane reflection has been carefully studied and ruled out.
In 1950 we have the McMinnville UFO photographs in McMinnville, Oregon. And this is the account where two farmers took pictures of a purported flying saucer. It is claimed that these are among the best known UFO pictures and continue to be analyzed and debated to this very day. Skeptics will often ask why there aren't any better UFO photos available. In fact, there are UFO photos out there that have withstood expert analysis. The best of which come from McMinnville, Oregon, taken on May 11, 1950 by farmer Paul Trent.
Bruce Maccabee, PhD.
By analyzing the two photos, it was possible to determine where Mr. Trent stood when he took the two photos, to within an accuracy of about a foot or so. And so, if you can imagine looking down from above, you can plot where he was standing and where the sighting lines went out. They said this object moved to the left, moved southward as you're looking towards the west, it moved slightly between pictures. And in fact, he was standing in one location for the first photo looking this way, and then he moved a little bit to the north. As this object was traveling along, he didn't want it to get blocked by the nearby garage, so he moved a little bit to his right, and then he looked and took a photo this way, and the sighting lines crossed. Now the overhead wires can be positioned where they were, and the sighting lines did not cross under the wires. So, you know, if it was a model, it wasn't hanging straight down under the wires.
The two photographs taken by Paul Trent provided a stereoscopic pair of pictures that gave researchers the data necessary to determine and measure distances to objects within a short range of the camera. Brad Sparks.
His altitude, or the altitude of the camera, also dropped by about a foot. So not only do you have a horizontal triangulation method, but you have a vertical triangulation method. Now when you combine those two methods of distance determination, you can determine the distance to every short-range object in those photos. And the UFO model, if that's what it was, does not fit. It is not at the close range of those overhead wires that were about 15 feet away from the camera. They don't fit the location and distance of the garage or the house or the trees that were several hundred feet away in the background. There is no indication that this is a hoax. The indications are totally that they actually saw some object flying past their farm and took two photos of it. In the 1960s, the U.S. Air Force contracted an outside scientific study of UFOs to be conducted by the University of Colorado. The astronomer William Hartman concluded that this was one of the few cases in which all of the geometric, photometric, and photogrammetric aspects agreed that there was an object, extraordinary object, tens of meters in size and metallic in appearance, about a mile away. Which would seem to be consistent with an alien visitation. Even though that's pretty hard to believe.
Hard to believe, perhaps, but in the McMinnville case, it's hard to escape the conclusion that a picture really is worth a thousand words.
In 1951, we have the Lubbock lights, in Lubbock, Texas, and these lights were repeatedly spotted flying over the city of Lubbock, Texas in a V formation with 20 or 30 of them at a time. The sighting was so popular and highly publicized that the photos and story appeared in Life magazine in 1952. The witnesses included professors from Texas Tech University, and they were even photographed by a Texas Tech student, as this report shows.
For a few weeks in 1951, people here witnessed a phenomenon of a different sort. A series of UFO sightings that five decades later still defy explanation.
Fox 4 News reports.
Beginning August 25, 1951, and for several nights that followed, a strange line of bluish lights was seen flying swiftly over Lubbock, Texas. This is a classic case for a number of different reasons, including the first group of people who saw the Lubbock lights, for college professors from Texas Tech University. They attempted to make a study of what they had seen, a scientific study, and were not wholly successful. But in the end, they concluded that the Lubbock lights were under intelligent control.
You know, we aren't talking about the flying saucer lunatic fringe here or something. We are talking about professional people who are apparently impressed enough by having seen strange things in the sky to go out and try to observe them under scientific conditions.
Donald Rugulosin is a present-day college professor from Roswell, New Mexico, who says comparisons can be made to a more recent incident. On March of 1997, when hundreds of people witnessed a flotilla of flying objects over Phoenix, Arizona. Back in 1951, no one in Lubbock had a home video camera, but an 18-year-old college freshman named Carl Hart Jr. was a budding still photographer who was just about to go to bed when he saw the Lubbock lights.
So, I just grabbed my camera and set the exposure to where I wanted and ran outside. I waited and then two more flights came over. I took two pictures of one and three of the other. My first process, I didn't think I had a thing. It didn't take up much room on the negative.
Hart took the photos to his Boy Scout leader, who contacted a reporter for the local newspaper, which eventually published them, but only after Hart endured the first in a series of grillings.
First, I talked to the people at the Avalanche Journal. Well, they were all pretty skeptical, and then after they published, well, first it was the Air Force.
Local Air Force investigators turn Hart over to higher-ups from out of town and eventually to FBI agents.
Pretty intense questioning. They went over and over my story, and I guess they were trying to get me to be inconsistent, but apparently they were satisfied eventually.
Life magazine published a lengthy article in the spring of 1952, and over the years a number of independent studies were conducted. After nearly 5 decades of intense scrutiny, there is no reason to believe that Carl Hart faked anything. His photos are still among the most remarkable and vexing in UFO history. The government's official report was released in late 1951, and its conclusion, what Carl Hart captured on film were highly reflective duck bellies.
Very clearly, this imaging shows that these are not birds.
Dr. Burleson, with advanced degrees in both mathematics and literature, is conducting what could be the most intensive computer analysis of Hart's photographs to date.
This is, in my estimation, the most spectacular of the photos. It shows a regular flotilla of 18 large disc-like objects in the sky. I'm inclined to think that these objects may well each have been in excess of 200 feet in diameter.
Carl Hart has never sought fame or fortune from the photos he took, just the opposite.
If it comes up, I would just as soon ignore it. I guess there's a group of people who still feel like anyone who's seen a UFO is kind of a nutcase, and I get put in that category part of the time. Part of the people think that anything like that has to be fake, so I get a little bit of that.
Even the government's analysis, some of it declassified years later, concluded there was no evidence of a hoax, that the negatives had not been retouched. That the lights were brighter than stars, and that the objects changed position in the formation.
In 1952 we have the Washington DC UFO incident. In July 1952, there was a series of sightings accompanied by radar contacts at three separate airports in the Washington, D.C. area. First spotted on an air traffic controller's radar, and they were moving in unusual flight patterns that witnesses called bright orange lights. An Air Force public information officer, Lieutenant Colonel Moncel Monti, confirmed the directive, stating, "The jet pilots are, and have been, under orders to investigate unidentified objects and to shoot them down if they can't talk them down." It was further stated that no pilot had been able to get close enough to take a shot at one of the flying saucers because they would disappear or speed away as soon as they were approached, sometimes outflying their pilots by as much as 1,000 miles an hour. In fact, the incident was so publicized that even President Truman demanded an explanation.
Strange lights over the U.S. Capitol more than 50 years ago. Fox 5's Brooke Baldwin investigates UFOs in Washington.
Fox 5 News reports.
The sky is the stage, the actors are so-called flying saucers, and they are back on the scene with some new twists. July 1952, air traffic controllers at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland pick up 10 to 12 unidentified objects on radar. Minutes later, another sighting, this time at Washington National Airport. The Air Force sent up two fighter aircraft to intercept the flying objects, according to confidential security information now released to the public.
The Air Force did respond in scrambled chats, and it was imaged and photographed over. I believe there were 9 of them at one point that were seen in formation.
Dr. Stephen M. Greer is the founder of the Disclosure Project. His organization collects information on unexplained sighting from all over the world, including the more than 2,000 reports from around D.C. in the summer of 52, now known as the Washington Nationals.
It's been very hard to bring out the information without it getting linked instantly to something that ends up being embarrassing. The famous photo shows 7 bright objects flying near the Capitol Dome. Radar also picked up 4 more objects in Deltsville and in Herndon. Facing increased pressure from the public, the military held a news conference saying the objects seen throughout the region were weather-related and nothing more than, quote, temperature inversion. We have, as of date, formed only one firm conclusion, with respect to this remaining percentage, and that is that it does not contain any pattern of purpose or of consistency that we can relate to any perceivable threat to the United States.
A conceivable threat that made it all the way to the Oval Office.
Captain Kevin Randall.
The President got very interested and wanted some kind of a solution.
Reserve Air Force Captain Kevin Randall has been studying UFOs for years. He has written 18 books, one of them specifically about the DC sightings.
What the Air Force said, basically, well, what it was is temperature inversions. Were there inversion layers over Washington, D.C. in the summer of July 1952? The answer is yes, there were. Were they of sufficient strength to cause the problems you see on the radar? No. Controversy arises, maybe the puzzling objects are from another planet?
Puzzling objects Dr. Greer believes are behind a cover-up at the highest level.
Everyone who I know who are military or intel were told you didn't see this. You were not in the squadron that went up. The radar operators were told this never happened.
But, something did happen those July nights, whether it was alien or not is still debatable.
Kevin Randall believes it is only a matter of time before the truth comes out.
I believe what's going to happen eventually is that there is going to be a UFO event that is inexplicable and leaves the evidence behind that we cannot just explain away. The sightings, as you saw, made front page headlines around the nation and ultimately lead to the formation of the Robertson Panel by the CIA. In fact, during the 1950s, so many UFO sightings were reported around the world that the Air Force was publicly forced, at least to save face, to sit up and take notice. They couldn't let the American public think that they weren't interested in what surely posed a threat to national security. So, they began a series of official UFO investigations. The first was Project Sign, then Project Grudge, and finally concluded with Project Blue Book. In 1952, we have the Flatwoods Monster in Flatwoods, West Virginia. Six local boys and a woman reported seeing a UFO land, but they also said there was a bizarre-looking creature that appeared near the landing site itself. In 1953, we have the Ellsworth UFO case in Bismarck, North Dakota. This is the account where the U.S. military investigated a UFO incident in Bismarck, North Dakota, which is now one of the most significant radar visual cases in the history of UFO sightings. It was witnessed by almost 45 agitated citizens along with military air defense system personnel. The description was of a red glowing light that made long sweeping movements over a period of two nights. Then in 1955 we have the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter in Kentucky. This is an account where a group of strange, goblin-like creatures were not only reported to have been seen by a family. But these creatures were reported to have even attacked the family. The family shot at them several times with little or no effect.
They were simple people, just simple country people, you know, honest type people. The house was sort of run down and old, just a simple country life in farming, and they were just trying to make a living. You gonna play him again, Billy? Asked Taylor.
No, I figure, I know when I'm licked. Besides, I ain't got another dollar.
Answered Billy Ray.
When Billy Ray Taylor left the kitchen to fetch water from the nearby well, nothing could have prepared him for what would happen next. As he began to fill up his bucket, something unusual in the air caught his eye. Come quick, you ain't gonna believe it, something weird just fell out of the sky, a bright light or something.
I don't know what. It went lickety-split across the field, right there, and then it looked like it landed somewhere down in the gully. He told his family.
Here he goes again, Billy Ray, you are not only a bad card player, you are a very bad liar to boot.
Said Taylor. Why would I lie about something like that? Answered Billy Ray.
It scared him so that he went inside to tell his family. In disbelief, they put him down as a joke and told him to don't be doing this no more.
You've been doing this all the time.
Are you daft in the head, Billy Ray?
Trying pull a fast one? Taylor asked. Why would I do that? Billy Ray answers, still breathing hard.
No doubt Billy Ray's story amused the family.
Maybe it was a shooting star.
They were not in the habit of taking him seriously, and soon they cast it aside as a practical joke. No one even bothered to walk out to the gully on the chance that something was there. I don't know, maybe it was a shooting star for all I know. Says Billy Ray.
I think your brain is a shooting star, son. Said Lucky.
Ha ha, very funny.
Replies Billy Ray.
Before long, darkness fell over the small Kentucky homestead. At around 8 o'clock, Lucky's dogs began to bark violently as if an intruder was on the property.
What in the blazes is going on with those darn dogs, Lucky? I told you to get rid of those varmints. I can barely hear myself think, let alone read a good book. Glennie says. Shut your trap there, you be still. Lucky said. As the men stared out the window, they were startled to see a strange glow coming from the fields beyond.
Lonnie Langford was only 12 years old when he and the others encountered the mysterious invaders at Kelly.
His mother was Glennie Langford, also the mother of Lucky Sutton.
She and Lonnie, as well as his siblings, Charlton and Mary, would soon become witnesses to the impossible.
There was a house full of people there, and they were all terrified.
Instructing the family to stay inside, Lucky and Billy Ray warily walked outside to get a better look at their uninvited visitor.
What in the name of God is that? Billy Ray exclaimed.
As the thing came nearer, they could make out what seemed to be a small man, only a man unlike any they had ever seen before.
Everybody, you stay put and don't make a sound. I'll whip your ever-loving hide if you do. Lucky yelled to the family inside.
Lucky and Billy Ray would take no chances. Horrified, they raced back inside and grabbed their shotguns as the others looked on in stunned silence.
Back outside, the unearthly apparition was moving silently towards them. What in God's green earth is it?
Lucky asked.
I don't think God's got nothing to do with it, Lucky.
It's getting closer, Lucky.
It looks just like a little man. I ain't ever seen a little man with ears like that. Billy Ray yelled.
A goblin, that's what it is, a goblin, straight out of the pits of hell.
Lucky said.
What are we gonna do, Lucky? Billy Ray asked.
Shoot it. Lucky answered.
Gail Cook Kelly, resident.
They didn't hurt him. He kind of rolled up into a little ball and kind of rolled back down the hill over there, where the ship was. Inside the house, the men were confused and dazed, not sure what to do next, while the rest of the family, especially Glennie Langford and the children, remained vigilant next to the bed. Landiga saw Lucky, you're nearly scaring those kids half to death. Glennie exclaimed. For God's sake, woman, there's a thing out there. Lucky warned her. What kind of a thing is it, Billy? Glennie asked. The kind of a thing that the Lord never intended to be in this universe. Do you hear me, woman? We have got to protect our home. Billy Ray told her. Oh, Lucky, why did you have to go and shoot it? It probably never meant us any harm, you might have killed it. Glennie said. We didn't kill it, Glennie. Our bullets sounded like they hit nickel plate or something. It ain't human, and what ain't human don't deserve to live.
O.P. Baker.
My name is O.P. Baker and I was in the house that night and I saw them creatures.
O.P. Baker, brother of Eileen Sutton, was 30 years old in 1955, a farm laborer who lived in Hopkinsville at the time, but often stayed overnight at the farmhouse where the person with whom he rode to work could pick him up more conveniently than they could in town. Today he is the only known adult survivor who was present on the night of the close encounter at Kelly.
Back then I wasn't going to no church, but I started church and have been going ever since. I remember we all were sitting there about, I'd say around 8 o'clock, when we heard a noise up on top of the roof. Listen, Mom, listen, there's something up on the roof. I was told that these beings were up on the roof scratching and clawing, trying to get through the ceiling. The children and mothers, that were in the house at the time, were trying to hide, trying to get away from this, they were all scared. One of the kids were saying, make it go away, just make it go away, please make it go away. There was one up on top of the house, on the awning, one was scratching on the windows, I mean they were like curious. Wanting to see what's going on. Far as the guns being shot, I don't know if it was on the far side of the house or this side, I do know that they said they come over. They say that curiosity killed the cat, but, in this instance, the curious just grew more curious as the unknown beings once again emerged from the shadows. Well, he said that they would come up to the windows and they would just stick to the side of the house like a spider. And he said, it would just kind of peek around the windowsill with its head and those big, beady eyes in the window and just stare. Mama screamed, and I jumped up out of the bed and looked out the window and I saw him. They were about 3 foot tall, had pointed ears, webbed feet and hands, and big round eyes. They had great big ears, I mean big ears, and you could shoot em and it wouldn't hurt em. And he said they would stare until one of them blew it off the windowsill. He said, once you shot it off the windowsill, he said you'd run outside and shoot them again. Then by the time I got back in the house and look at the other window and there's another one looking in the window. Yeah, I was real scared. I was in the corner of the house on the floor. Everybody was running around the house just panicked. I didn't know what was going on.
What do you think's going on? Glennie asked. God help us, Glennie, I don't know. I just don't know, Billy Ray answered. I think it's demons, more than likely Billy Ray. Hell has indeed come to this little house tonight, Lucky said. I think I killed it, Lucky, I couldn't have missed at such a close range, Lib said.
Lib, why isn't it lying prone to the ground just like any normal human being?
You do know what happened the first time we shot it?
Well, I don't care if it's the devil himself, I'm going outside to finish him off. Him and his minions from the deep dark outer space or wherever he comes from, said Billy Ray.
I believe it was a 20 gauge they were using, my father had, and I believe Billy Ray had a 22. JC had another shotgun, and as all three are shooting at these things, none of them could make a hit to actually kill one of these creatures.
Wendell McCord, Glennie Lankford's nephew.
One of these green men reached down and got him by the hair of the head. One of the little men had picked him up by his hair, and then that's when they started shooting, and all the little kids like my age were on the bed terrified. I can't say for sure, but I do know that there are facts proving that something of a higher power had landed in their backfield.
When they made a direct hit on the creatures, it sounded as if their bullets had struck the center of a metal bucket.
They just never could kill one of them. They just seemed to bounce off. He said, there was a battle, they would get on the window sills, scare the women, they would have to run inside and blow them off the window sills. Then they'd run outside to see where they were, and they'd be in the trees, and they'd blow them out of the trees.
After taking a direct hit, the creature seemed to defy gravity as it floated off and landed in a grassy area several yards away.
Cautiously, the shooters moved towards the spot where they believed it had fallen. To their surprise, a luminous glow appeared on the ground where the thing had been.
Dr. Barry Taff.
These beings, these creatures, whatever they were, wherever they were from, displayed a very unusual intrigue and, I guess, curiosity that is uncommon with this type of phenomenon. According to the witnesses, the creature seemed capable of extremely rapid movement when running away, and it was impossible to tell whether there were several of them or whether there were only two or three that disappeared from one place and reappeared very quickly in another. Most of the officers were reluctant to express any opinions about the reported invasion, but all seemed impressed at the evident fright and sincerity of the highly excited family. A check with neighbors revealed that they were not prone to drinking and no evidence of alcohol was found around the place. All the witnesses told practically the same story with only minor variations depending on what part of the house they were in at the time of the happening.